Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today, it's the latest in our Where They Stand series, looking at what the presidential candidates are saying about issues important to New Hampshire voters. This hour, we examine their stances on climate change.
We are fighting for the survival of the planet Earth, our only planet.
What we have to dispel is this idea that it's happening 100 years from now. It's happening right now.
Poison is being belched into the air of creation. And people are being harmed by it. Countries are at risk of vanishing in low-lying areas. We suppose God thinks of that.
The question is, are we willing to put the resources into it? And my answer is, yeah, we better be willing to put the resources into it because the alternative is unthinkable.
Coming up, we look at the major themes and where the differences are. And let's get your input. What do you want to hear these presidential hopefuls say about climate change? Let us know. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Annie Ropeek, NHPR's energy and environment reporter. Annie, thank you very much for helping us out.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us from California, Leah Stokes, assistant professor of political science at UC Santa Barbara. Leah's forthcoming book is called Short-Circuiting Policy: Interest Groups and the Battle Over Clean Energy and Climate Policy in the American States. And Leah, really nice to have you too. Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Annie, you've been talking to New Hampshire voters about this. What are they saying about climate change?
So they really want to hear about it. This has been one of the top issues that people have been asking candidates about, have been expressing as what they're voting on throughout the campaign all year. You know, we've done our own surveys at NHPR that said that this is right up there in the top three with healthcare, sometimes immigration or gun control. I mean, it's a big one. And so they are listening for what the candidates have to say on it, but they don't always know what to make of what they hear, I think. I mean, when you ask people to get specific on the kind of policies they're looking for, I think people don't always know exactly what they are looking for because this is a really complicated issue. And really on the campaign trail, the candidates have talked about it in really broad strokes, as we just heard, which is important. And people really want to hear that. They want to hear a sense of urgency, a sense that the candidates understand and acknowledge the science, really basic things like that. But, you know, when you get into the details that we're going to talk about today, people are a little bit less sure what to do about that. And I think it really speaks to this anxiety people have about the issue overall, that they kind of wonder in the back of their minds, like, even if someone is elected who really cares about this, what can they do? And, you know, will it work? And do we have enough time? And how is it going to affect me? And they have a lot of unanswered questions, even when they do hear what they want to hear.
Well, you talk to a lot of voters about this, and I want to play a little bit from one of those voters. This is Elizabeth Deutsch. She's a nurse who attended a candidate climate forum in New Hampshire in August. And she reflects what you're talking about, Annie, that they really care about this issue, but it feels overwhelming and complicated. Let's hear.
It is hard to take science and move that into a quick soundbite. There's so much education that has to go on in order to make the true scope of this problem really understood, as to why we need to quote, tighten our belts around this issue.
Again, that's one of the voters that Annie Ropeek talked to, Elizabeth Deutsch, at a candidate forum in August. Leah, to bring you into it, compare the attention and concern that voters are expressing about this issue now versus the presidential campaign 4 years ago.
Well, I think that voters have actually been quite worried about climate change for a long time. You can look at data from the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication, which collects surveys of the American public and make estimates of what states and even counties and even districts think. And You know, there's been a lot of support for climate action for a long time, but that didn't translate into coverage during the presidential primaries or even the generals. We didn't see almost any discussion in the 2016 race. So things have changed enormously, and the media is finally starting to focus on this issue that the public has been supportive of for quite a long time.
Well, what's behind that increased attention or interest or coverage, Leah?
Well, there's a lot of different theories behind that. I think that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, which is this really big body of scientists from around the world, this time last year, they released a report, and the media did an excellent job framing it in terms of, we have 12 years to act. And I think that broke through for a lot of people. It started to become clear that climate change is happening now, that we have to act now. And when you look at the wildfires in my home state of California, but really across the West, if you look at the horrendous hurricanes, all of these impacts are starting to happen. I'm sure in New Hampshire, people are noticing less snow, less cold winters, hotter summers, and people are starting to wake up that climate change is in the here and now.
What about that, Annie? I'd love your reflections on that from a New Hampshire perspective.
Yeah, I think you really are hearing people. I mean, when Leah mentioned the wildfires, it made me think that that's something people bring up a lot. I think people have a sense, you know, that they have seen more climate change impacts just in the past year. You know, and it's a combination of there's been more coverage, there's been more science sort of translated into the public eye, like at the same time as some of these really clear effects. And there's also been more science that actually is able to link those individual events to the climate change conditions that we have, saying, you know, if you run models on this, that it's clear this wouldn't have happened if our emissions picture was different than it is. And so that really gets through to people. And I remember the CNN town halls on climate change that happened earlier this fall that I think some of your clips you played earlier were from. It was incredible because that was during one of the big wildfires that they had in California this year. And at the beginning of every new candidate, they would sort of give an update, like a news update on what was happening out there. They would show live pictures of it. And I mean, it really brought this sort of visceral sense to it that I think we haven't seen the issue have in the past. And, so that gives it a sense of urgency for voters in the way that other issues have, like healthcare and immigration, you know, that you can point to things in the here and now, and climate change is there now too.
Annie, you mentioned earlier that voters you talk to, you know, aren't sure about the specifics yet, but they do feel this urgency. They do want to hear that candidates are going to move quickly on this. I want to play a little bit from Andrew Yang. Here he is speaking in Portsmouth in August, and he's saying Americans really need to move now.
But we can lower emissions, we can get our people to higher ground, and we have to act very, very quickly. So moving people to higher ground means owning the fact that climate change is real, it's advancing, and that the public resources need to be put into place to make us all safer and help our communities adapt.
So that's Andrew Yang. And Annie, what strikes me about that is he's talking not just about, you know, what I would do, the clean energy strategies I might adopt or whatever. He's talking about adaptation to things that are already happening.
Yeah, it's been really interesting to see how the candidates balance sort of the ways to address and fix and even roll back the effects of climate change with the need to respond to what it's already doing and what's kind of baked in at this point, which is a great deal of these effects. I mean, we are guaranteed to see some amount of sea level rise and some amount of increased storm events and fire seasons, all of that stuff that's already happening. I mean, you know, no matter what we do on the clean energy side of things on reducing emissions, science says that, you know, we're already past some points of no return, not at every point, surely, but, you know, we're definitely on our way down the path. And so Andrew Yang touts a lot about his policies that he says sort of acknowledge that more than others. And, you know, I did notice in comparing these candidates' plans that it's a lot harder to talk about adaptation, I think, than what I would call mitigation of the effects, because I don't know that people really know what to do yet. And also, in some sense, it may be seen as more of a local issue, and it's not so clear what the federal government's role could be in helping with that problem besides providing funding. But you do see the candidates touch on a lot of, for example, flood insurance reform or other federal emergency management reforms. You see them talk about funding for the Forest Service and wildfire protection training and specific things like that, coastal infrastructure upgrades. Those are things that the federal government can do. So you see the candidates talk about that, but it's a lot easier to get into specifics and into the weeds on clean energy transition and, you know, transportation infrastructure, things like that.
Sure. And to put on your political science science hat, Leah, how do candidates sort of straddle what Annie is talking about? Because talking about this is my exciting new clean energy strategy, you know, that's sort of positive and hopeful. Talking about adaptation to the stuff that, as Annie put it, is already baked in, that's a little more depressing. I wonder how you hear candidates working with that.
Yeah, I think that politicians do a better job communicating on climate change in general terms when they talk about opportunity. And there's a lot of opportunity where climate change is concerned, because we can create a new economy. That means that we can pay people good paying jobs. We can lift people out of poverty. We can be cleaning up the air. There's a lot of things that we can be doing. And some people view paying for adaptation actually as a way of waking people up to the sheer costs of inaction. If you start to look at as a town at what you're going to do with sea level rise, pretty quickly you realize that dealing with climate change and getting the federal government to act after, you know, way more than 30 years of inaction is a much better idea than waiting for the problem to show up in your local community where you're cash strapped and it's really hard to deal with the impacts, because there aren't really quick fixes for some of these impacts. And it makes a lot more sense to try to reduce our emissions and help other countries all around the world do the same.
Annie, go ahead.
Yeah, there's two really interesting things in there that I wanted to follow up on. The first is this focus on jobs and the economy. I think we hear activists say a lot that, you know, for too long, climate action has been divorced or even set against the idea of economic development, and that instead the two should be completely
it's
married.
It's been an either or. It's
right,
been positioned that way
for
a long time.
Where instead it has great potential to be for them to be completely linked.
Because it's new sectors.
Right, exactly. So new jobs and new kinds of energy, jobs building new infrastructure, retraining people who've worked in the fossil fuel industry to work in clean energy industries or other, you know, new sectors, which you see the candidates all make a point of really saying, well, here's what we're going to do for the fossil fuel workers who are going to be displaced, and also for affected communities generally, that we're going to funnel, you know, job training and economic development into those communities. So we're seeing the candidates really emphasize that and frame this as an economic opportunity and something that America could lead on, you know, in the technology sector and that kind of thing. So that's one thing. And I think people are really picking up on that, on the, you know, voters wise. And then the other thing that Leah mentioned I wanted to note was this idea that municipalities and even states don't exactly know where to start on the idea of adaptation. It made me think of Hampton and Hampton Beach in New Hampshire, which is going to be pretty much our most affected community by sea level rise just because of its geography, and one of the most affected in all of New England. And when you talk to local planners there, they literally will say, we don't know where to start. Like, we physically don't have the, not just the financial resources, but like blueprints and the policy tools and the research and the sort of the stuff on paper that you need to get some of these processes started. And so they need some of that maybe coming from the federal government, from Housing and Urban Development or from the Department of Energy, whatever it is, to help them even know what to do and to set up some of those new systems, because you can't do this within the framework that exists now.
It's almost like they could be a test case for a community of adaptation.
And they already are, you know, playing that role in New Hampshire, but I think they have a lot left that that could help them, you know, do that.
As both of you talk about presenting climate change as a positive opportunity to create new sectors and new types of jobs, here's a little bit from our forum with Mayor and Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg. He says he'd move quickly on clean energy. He talks a lot about, you know, those clean energy jobs and so forth. But Mayor Buttigieg, being a Midwesterner, also emphasizes engaging rural America and agriculture in what he calls carbon capture, which is basically using plants to pull carbon out of the atmosphere. Let's hear.
There are some estimates that would suggest we can take as much carbon out of the atmosphere just using soil as the entire global transportation sector puts in. And so as we move to make sure less carbon's going in, we should also pursue every strategy we can think of to get it out. Because while there are some things we can act on very quickly, we can double clean energy on the grid by 2025. We can move very quickly toward electric vehicles. There are some things, some industrial processes and ships and planes that are still going to exist 10, 20, 30 years from now, that we're going to have to figure out ways to offset what they do.
Again, that's Mayor Pete Buttigieg in our forum with him earlier this month. I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. It's another in our Where They Stand series. This is an NHPR newsroom-wide series outlining what the presidential candidates are saying about issues important to New Hampshire voters. And today, it's climate change. We're looking at some of the big themes that we've been hearing from these candidates. And we'd love to hear from you. What do you hope these candidates talk about when they talk about climate change? What do you feel is lacking? What do you like that you've heard on the campaign trail so far? Let us know. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Leah Stokes, couple things from that Pete Buttigieg clip that I just played. One is, what is he sort of signaling there, saying, look, you know, trucks and airplanes and so forth are still going to be with us 20 years out, so let's try and offset what they do. What's the sort of broader message there?
So there is some potential to be using natural climate solutions to try to offset emissions from hard to decarbonize sectors. That's what Pete is talking about. However, I think that that is a bit of an overestimate of what is possible. And I say that because a lot of our ecosystems are becoming more vulnerable and fragile because of the climate change that is already happening. So if we think about taking carbon from the air and storing it in forests and soils, which is what he's talking about, we have to also be thinking about the fact that many of those forests in Western United States are already burning up.
They're less healthy and less able to fulfill that role. Yeah, go ahead, Leah.
Yes, they're not storing carbon for the long term because they're literally lighting on fire. And when you burn something, carbon goes back into the atmosphere. So fossil fuels, what they are fundamentally is they are stored carbon from underground, not from forest ecosystems, but from deep inside the earth. And so what we actually need to do over the long term is not just store carbon back in ecosystems, but put it back underground. And that's not a justification for continuing to burn fossil fuels, but it is a solution to get some of the pollution out of the air and put it back underground.
So carbon capture, Leah, how sort of hopeful should we be about this? It sounds like you're a little less hopeful than Mayor Buttigieg.
Well, it's a really complex issue, and I think that it's great what Mayor Buttigieg is doing to focus on this. But my point is that what you actually should be focusing on is what we call negative emissions. And there's some new technology coming out of a research group at Harvard University that's the demonstration plant is based in British Columbia. And what this project can do is it can use solar power to take carbon out of the air and to either make synthetic fuels, which can power our airplanes, or ideally put that carbon back underground. And so it's really important that we invest more in this technology and scale it up around the world, but it cannot be used as a justification for continuing fossil fuel burning. What we have to do is use it to clean up the carbon that's already in the air that's putting, for example, New Hampshire communities at risk.
Go ahead, Annie.
Yeah, negative emissions technology and carbon capture at these industrial scales are really interesting. If you even listen to NPR, sometimes you will hear ads from ExxonMobil touting their plans to deploy carbon capture technology at industrial sites that emit carbon dioxide. And so this is seen as a something with strong potential for industry, but we also see, you know, candidates touting it at large scales. I mean, Pete Buttigieg, you know, speaks in gigatons of carbon capture infrastructure. And so we also have candidates like Bernie Sanders who say they don't want to invest in this at all, that it's basically like a red herring solution. And so this is a really interesting dividing line and one that I think we'll see continue to evolve.
Wow. All right. Well, lots more to talk about after a short break. And we'll start taking your calls. So join us. What do you want to hear this year's presidential candidates say about climate change? What have you heard so far? What more do you think should be said? Join us with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-8255. 888-787-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, where they stand on climate change. It's part of an NHPR newsroom-wide series examining the presidential candidates' plans on issues voters say they care about. Let's hear from you. What do you want to hear from these contenders about climate? What strategies do you wish they talked more about? Give us a call. Let us know. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests for the hour, Leah Stokes, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UC Santa Barbara. Leah's forthcoming book is called Short-Circuiting Policy, Interest Groups and the Battle Over Clean Energy and Climate Policy in the American States. In studio, Annie Ropeek, NHPR's Energy and Environment Reporter. And both of you, let's go right to our listeners. And David emails to say, I would like to see the U.S. take the lead in battling climate change instead of sitting on their hands as it is being done now. Leah, who is taking the lead on climate change, if not the U.S.? Who would you sort of give that nomination to?
Well, what I think Greta Thunberg has done such an excellent job pointing out is that nobody is really leading. A lot of countries, particularly Nordic countries like where she's from, or Norway, or places like Germany, have sort of pretended like they're leading, but they haven't really been moving the needle in a meaningful way. So, for example, in Germany, they invested an enormous amount of money into clean energy, into wind and solar particularly. But at the same time, they shut down their entire nuclear fleet. And the consequence was that coal barely moved at all. And so that country is continuing to use a very dirty and very polluting energy source at the end of the day. So nobody is doing what is necessary to get us on track with this really crucial issue. But that opens up an opportunity for the United States, because if the United States were to elect a Democratic president, and I would say Democrat because many Republicans, if not most, are completely still hanging out in climate denial, unfortunately, if we were to elect a Democrat, you know, in the coming presidential cycle, I think that we could start to be a leader in the world.
Well, to that point about Republicans, Arnie emails to ask, what are the GOP candidates, including the incumbent, saying? And then Christopher in Manchester writes, I hope you're not only focusing on the Democratic candidates. Governor Bill Weld has always been at the forefront of environmental conservation and protection and is certainly not in the climate denial wing of the Republican Party. So Arnie and Christopher, thank you. And yes, we definitely will talk about their policies. We sat down with Governor Weld, gosh, a couple months ago, Annie, and he said, when I asked him, what do you think the biggest foreign policy challenge is? He said climate. So Governor Weld is paying attention to this.
Yeah, it's I went to a forum with him that focused on climate change a couple months ago as well. And I mean, he's got just as detailed a plan on this issue as the Democrats. You know, we focused on the Democrats in our web build on this online. But Governor Weld has a carbon price proposal. He's got a lot of foreign policy details that he talks about when it comes to climate change. And the focus on foreign policy is a really interesting thing about these candidates' plans. People, especially like former Vice President Joe Biden, who have a lot of foreign policy experience, really focus on the global implications and the sort of international relations implications of dealing with climate change. So not just on what the U.S. can do about its own emissions, which, you know, we're in the top five of countries that contribute, but, you know, we still make up only, you know, a relatively small slice of the pie. And so global action is obviously going to be needed to bring the whole picture down. And candidates say they want to incentivize other countries to take more action. They want to broker global trade deals on this and global deals on lowering emissions. They want to penalize countries that don't take action on climate change by taxing their imports at the border or not doing trade with them, things like that. So there's a lot of foreign policy to be found in these plans, and some candidates focus on it more than others.
So since you talked about that and you mentioned Joe Biden, he does have lots of foreign policy experience, and he has expressed climate as a national security issue. Here he is at that CNN town hall on climate earlier this year, saying that climate disruption has led to war.
Look what happened in Darfur. What's Darfur all about? Darfur is all about the fact that the sub-Saharan desert, because of the change in climate, no longer had enough arable land. Look what's happened in Indonesia. They're talking about moving their capital because it's going to sink. What happens if you get 10, 12, 13, 1500 million people on the move? That causes wars.
Again, that's Joe Biden at the Climate Town Hall. And as again, one more question on the whole global focus on this, the foreign policy aspect of it. Michael emails to comment, I've heard a lot about the domestic policies that various candidates would put forward. But Michael says China puts out nearly as much CO2 as the next three top emitters, the United States, the EU, and India combined. Besides, quote, leadership, what, if any, steps have candidates put in place to force China to cut their CO2 emissions? Michael, thank you so much for the comment. And Leah, I'd love your thoughts.
Well, candidates like Elizabeth Warren have a very detailed trade plan that includes carbon border tax adjustments. And what that means is that if another country is not doing enough to cut their emissions, there will be consequences when they try to trade with the United States. She's also said in that plan that in order to trade with the United States, countries are going to need to participate in these global negotiations on climate change and actually make meaningful contributions to reductions. So I think that there are some candidates like Elizabeth Warren who are taking that seriously. I will say that I find the fixation on what other countries are doing, which Joe Biden has promoted a lot during the race, I find it very problematic because the reality is the United States is the largest emitter historically, and the United States is the world leader in technology and innovation. And here's the fact, if we take on this issue here, we can export our technology to countries around the world. And that's something that I think Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have been saying a lot more, and it's a really key part of solving this problem. So I don't think we should fixate and point fingers on at other countries. I think we should focus on the job creation opportunities here and then figure out how we can sell this technology to countries around the world and together reduce emissions globally.
Interesting. So again, a more positive framing. Instead of saying, boy, it's going to be difficult to clean this up and somebody else should go first, you're saying, Leah, let's focus on the positive, energizing attributes of fixing this problem.
And it's also just how it works. The United States has always been a global leader. We have always been the engine of research and development and innovation and technology. When we had a big problem with the ozone hole, that's how we solved it. We had American companies innovating, and then we had them selling their technology around the world. And that is actually, again, an idea that Elizabeth Warren has been promoting a lot. She has something called the Green Manufacturing Plan, which is about, hey, let's use this as an opportunity to innovate, and then let's sell and share our technologies with countries around the world to create an opportunity for Americans in manufacturing and creating good jobs along the way. So this doesn't have to be a place of conflict with countries around the world. It can be about cooperation and innovation and solutions. And I think we need a president who understands that.
Let's take some calls from listeners. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Lots of great emails coming in. Keep it up. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Matthew's calling from Keene. Hi, Matthew. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
I have two main comments, and one is the first thing we need to do is look in the mirror, look at our lifestyles, look at the choices we make and the votes we make and the fact we're not holding our representatives responsible for what they're doing. The second thing is nothing is going to happen from the government until you get rid of corruption. When you have people making big donations, they get positions. They get access. If I drive to Washington and I walk in any high office door, I'll see nobody. If I have contributed $500,000 or $1 million to campaigns, I'll be through the door. They'll probably buy me lunch.
Well, Matthew, thank you. And this fits in perfectly, Leah, with your forthcoming book called Short-Circuiting Policy, Interest Groups, and the Battle Over Clean Energy and Climate Policy. So if you want to comment on the money aspects of this that Matthew raises, I'd love to hear it.
Matthew is spot on, unfortunately. There is an enormous amount of evidence in my own research and research by Harvard professor Naomi Oreskes and many others that shows that the fossil fuel industry has really captured our political system. They have promoted climate denial for over 30 years, and that includes electric utilities, as well as fossil fuel companies like Exxon. And unfortunately, I have research that shows that when these companies are going and meeting with our congressional representatives, they are bending what they think the public thinks about climate change. And so the more they're meeting with groups from the fossil fuel industry, the more they're taking money from the fossil fuel industry, the worse job that these politicians and their staff do at guessing the public support that exists for climate action. And there's also been research that shows that donations do gain access. So when people are giving a lot of money from corporations, that they are more likely to get in the door, just as Matthew is describing. So I think he's right that the fossil fuel industry has captured our political system, has lied about the science of climate change, and has allowed us to get into a really big mess where we have very little time to start to reduce emissions and to protect everyday Americans from the terrible impacts that are already happening in their communities.
Well, I'm glad you called, Matthew, because, Annie, his call sort of raises two ends of the spectrum. One is saying, look at these big fossil fuel companies, look at members of Congress who are sort of doing their bidding because of the money. But initially, Matthew said, we need to look at our own lifestyles. And I wonder what you hear the candidates on the campaign trail saying about, hey, America, look at your own lifestyle. Did you walk to work if you could? Did you, you know, I don't know, try and use less plastic or whatever?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting that Matthew pointed out lifestyle choices, but then said we also need to look at our political choices. Because one thing I always think about when people say, well, you need to do more to fight climate change, you know, what can you do? I mean, the single biggest thing that you can do on any issue is vote on it. I mean, in, you know, especially in years like this where these candidates are proposing really transformative policies on not just climate change, but plenty of other issues, you know, voting matters. And the people you put in office are the ones who have control over sort of the bigger levers of this issue. So you can make choices on your own personal level. You can drive a Prius. You can use, you know, less plastic, and you can try to reduce your own footprint by composting, all of that kind of stuff, which is great. And I mean, it reduces your own impact within your own life. It probably saves you money. I mean, there's plenty of reasons to make those changes. But as far as the sort of need for big global change on the scale that's required in the timeline that's required, political action is going to be what does it, and action sort of on the corporate scale, which gets to Matthew's second point about, you know, money in politics and sort of the influence of these corporations on the system. And it brought to mind one interesting aspect of some of these candidates' plans, which is so we have Biden, Buttigieg, Sanders, Warren, and Yang all endorsing this plan that I think is pretty much based on a bill that Elizabeth Warren has in Congress to require companies disclose their sort of exposure to climate risk as part of their public valuations, and sometimes to disclose their actual greenhouse gas emissions output, sort of as a way of incorporating climate change into these companies', you know, business role and sort of their public image in a way that it's not currently there.
Let's take another call. Matthew, thank you very much for that one. Phil is in Loudoun calling in. Hi, Phil. Go ahead. You're in the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning. Go ahead, Phil.
How are you?
I'm good. Go ahead.
Well, my question basically has to do with, we have less than 10 years really to prepare for the real physics of climate change. And as a retired science teacher from Concord, my biggest concern is that we're not preparing our students for the rigors that they're going to need to be able to produce to deal with climate change.
So you would like to see candidates, Phil, talking more about educating the next generation? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, Phil, it's good to hear from you. Annie, what do you think?
I think that's really interesting. It's something I've wanted to report on that we're hoping to report on more next year.
You should be in touch with Phil.
I wrote down Phil's name. It's climate education and sort of the role of climate change in curriculum. But also just, I mean, we see sort of unprecedented mobilization of young people on this issue. I mean, it's what gets them out protesting, you know, maybe top above gun control. Like, it's a big thing for them. Greta Thunberg, as Leah mentioned, has been leading global activism on this. You know, teenagers in New Hampshire are incredibly active on this issue. And I think they all recognize the problem. One thing that Phil's comment brought to mind for me was sort of the future employment aspects of this. I mean, are people prepared to work in the industry or to not live on the coast and that kind of thing? And I think, you know, this is a generation that's grown up acknowledging the problem. And so I think is probably uniquely prepared to make decisions based around it. But I think the technical education aspect of this is something we see come up in the candidates' plans is, you know, actually like preparing a workforce for these issues and not waiting until we need the workforce and then starting that process 10 years from now.
It's great to hear from you, Phil. And a couple of emails I'd love to share with both of you. Abby emails. She says, I'd like to see more candidates consider modern nuclear technologies. They can be very safe, produce a relatively small amount of waste, and produce base load of power that is essential to the grid. Abby says, many modern nuclear technologies plan to consume existing nuclear waste as fuel. There is plenty of nuclear energy available to sustain our society for over 100 years while we develop other future energy sources. Abby, I am so glad that you emailed because I did want to ask both of you about nuclear power. And to you first, Leah, all these candidates talk about clean energy, but I have found some real divides among them in terms of nuclear power. Bill Weld, I believe, was in favor of nuclear power. Pete Buttigieg said, you know, existing nuclear plants, okay, but let's not build any new ones. I believe that was the response from Elizabeth Warren as well. So what do you think, Leah? How are these candidates talking about nuclear power?
Well, this is a great question. And the fact is that today, 55% of the U.S.'s clean electricity comes from nuclear power. And we've seen that when states like Vermont or California start to phase it out, they really struggle to reduce their emissions. Sometimes emissions even go up. And we've also seen that in Germany, as I mentioned. And so I think we have to get really clear-eyed about how little time we have and how taking offline safe nuclear plants is a really bad idea. We're about to see this play out in New York State with one nuclear plant closing. And, you know, we have seen this play out in Vermont. And my understanding is that Bernie Sanders played a role in shutting down that nuclear plant. And during the campaign, he has been very anti-nuclear, and that raises really big concerns for me, not because I love nuclear per se, but because I love reducing emissions. And if we take existing nuclear off the table, which is something that Bernie Sanders has been very strong in saying he wants to do, I think we have really big concerns about emissions going up. So I tend to think that we should take an approach that's similar to what Jay Inslee was promoting when he was still in the race. And it's also similar to what Pete Buttigieg and Elizabeth Warren are currently promoting, which is that we can keep safe nuclear plants open, the ones that already exist, for as long as we need to and as long as they're safe. And then we can start to ramp up renewables to fill that gap. I think that building new nuclear will face some serious challenges. I don't think we should take it off the table, and that's something that Joe Biden is more interested in. But certainly keeping existing safe nuclear open is a crucial thing that we have to do as a country.
Well, we've been asking the candidates about it when they come in for our forums. We, NHPR, asked Cory Booker about nuclear power. Here's what Senator Booker said.
Right now, nuclear is more than 50% of our non-carbon causing energy. So people who think that we can get there without nuclear being part of the blend just aren't looking at the facts.
Again, that's Cory Booker, and I misspoke. That is Cory Booker at the CNN Town Hall on Climate Change in California this fall. By the way, Senator Booker will be with us on The Exchange January 3rd. You can go to our website if you want more information about that event. It'll be live here in Studio D on Friday, January 3rd. Our website, by the way, nhpr.org/exchange. Thank you for that email. Great point, Abby. And we'll take more of your emails after a short break. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, the weekly news roundup looks at the top Granite State stories of 2019. Join us for this special year-end edition of the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup with Peter Biello. That is Friday morning, live at 9. Today, where they stand, NHPR's series on how the 2020 presidential candidates are talking about key issues important to New Hampshire voters. And today, it's climate change. We've been hearing from you. Keep those emails coming in, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We want to know what you want to hear from these candidates as they talk about climate change. Once again, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And Leah Stokes, Annie Ropeek, right back to our listeners. Jordan emailed from Boston, who says, offsets are a pipe dream because they can become carbon saturated and won't absorb anymore. The oceans are a good example. Cap and trade is like saying, I can cheat on my partner, so as long as I pay you not to. So overall, the morality is neutral. It's as ridiculous as it sounds. Jordan says, what we need to focus on is new technology and incentivize and mandate that they be developed and mass produced. He says, what I'm afraid of is the status quo will just continue on for the next nigh of century and future generations will suffer beyond measure. So, Jordan, thank you. Lots to unpack there. And he talked a lot about, I hope that we will look ahead to technologies and being innovative around this. Leah, this is something you've talked about. You've mentioned Elizabeth Warren. So let's play a little bit from Senator Warren. This is at our forum with her earlier this year. She really talked about doubling down on the research. She seemed less interested in a carbon tax, although she said she was open to it. Let's hear.
Although I want to be clear, it's just not going to be enough. I don't think that's, if we'd done that 25 years ago, we'd be in a very different position. Today, I think what are going to be the real drivers of attacking climate change are going to be about having regulation in some key industries and about things like a green manufacturing plan, which I'm glad to talk about.
Again, that's Elizabeth Warren from our forum with her earlier this fall. Leah, what about that? You've touched on what Senator Warren has said about green manufacturing, really doubling down and doubling down and doubling down on technology. Is that the way out, or is it just saying, yeah, yeah, we can solve this if all the smart scientists will help us?
I do feel that that is the way out. I think that industrial policy is the solution to this problem, and that a narrow price on carbon, just like Senator Warren said in that clip, is not going to get us where we need to go fast enough. And this is really what the Green New Deal is all about. It's about saying we have to have solutions at the scale of the problem. And that means we have to take a kind of war approach like we did in World War II, where the government said, in partnership with industry, hey, we got to solve this problem. We got to build a lot of stuff really quickly, and you're going to help us get there. And I think that regulation and industrial policy is really the pathway forward on this issue. And going with a narrow carbon price is not going to get us where we need to go fast enough. So I tend to think that Elizabeth Warren has a pretty smart approach on this exact issue that your listener raised.
It's interesting. Emily writes about the carbon tax, Emily in Peterborough. She says, please don't call it a tax, which is divisive. A price on carbon, Emily says, corrects a market failure by including a portion of the detrimental health and climate effects of burning fossil fuels. Emily says this market failure has been there all along, but we tolerated it for decades because of the economic benefits of low energy costs. A carbon cost is a market mechanism with bipartisan support. The barriers to it are minor compared to its potential to slow carbon emissions. Emily, thank you. And Annie, I want to ask you also what you're hearing about carbon taxes when you talk to candidates and when you talk to voters.
It's been really interesting to see candidates shift on this. Because
they talked a lot about it earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it's often touted as, you know, economists' favorite solution. It's like sort of the most obvious thing that you could do to at least account for emissions in the economy, right? I mean, just on paper, it makes sense. But I think we've seen candidates beginning, as Leah said, to say that this is not going to do enough fast enough. We've seen Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, I believe Tulsi Gabbard also is on that list of people who have come out and said flatly, you know, I don't think that this is something that we should be prioritizing. Elizabeth Warren has been a little more waffly on it, but, you know, that's sort of...
She said I'd consider
it. Yeah, the tone. I mean, I think she's not making it her sort of priority policy is the point. And so You know, this is something that states debate a lot at the state level. We have versions of carbon pricing already in the Northeast for power plant emissions, but nothing economy-wide. And, you know, I mean, at this point, I think Leah is right that there are probably sort of bigger scale steps that if we haven't done this one by now, we might want to just skip ahead to the next biggest scale item. I don't know. I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see how that one plays out, because it is sort of a step that I think the public has come to kind of understand, but maybe we've almost run out of time for it to be useful at scale. At least that's what some of the candidates are starting to say.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I have noticed a similar shift, Annie. We asked Tom Steyer about this when he was at our forum earlier this year. And Tom Steyer, you know, known for really investing lots of his personal wealth in climate change organizations. But Mr. Steyer said, look, carbon tax doesn't work. And it hurts people who can least afford it. And no, I would not do that. He said instead he would declare climate change a, quote, national emergency using all the powers of the presidency.
The first thing that has to happen is to clean up electricity generation. And that is something that can be regulated, and the emergency powers of the presidency can set goals on that nationwide. I think you can set building codes in terms of building efficiency. And you can set miles per gallon goals as well, and goals for electric vehicles. So in fact, there's a lot you can do through the regulatory powers of the presidency to determine how energy is generated and used in the United States right off the bat, and I would.
Again, that's Tom Steyer at our forum with him this fall. And Leah, what can a president do in these big, broad strokes that you and Annie are talking about? And how much does he or she need buy-in from Congress, buy-in from communities, buy-in from states and so forth? How much power does the president really have to make a big change on this?
Well, I think that's the trillion-dollar question, so to say. You know, we need to be able to act on this issue. And if we continue to have 99 out of 100 Republicans in Congress, let alone the climate denier-in-chief, opposing action in any meaningful way, if we are lucky enough to get a Democrat in office who, you know, believes and supports climate action, then they're likely going to need to use executive authority. And the fact is, we have the Clean Air Act on the books. We've had that on the books since the early 1970s. And that law actually says, because of a ruling between Massachusetts and the EPA at the Supreme Court, that the federal government has a requirement to regulate carbon as a pollutant. And so that gives a fair amount of scope for the federal government to lead on this issue. And another thing that a future president can do is that they can ban new fossil fuel development on public lands. And that's something that both Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have been very strong about saying they would do as a top priority. You know, that doesn't go far enough, but it is a very easy thing that is within executive authority. And I think that we are starting to see more of the presidential candidates flesh out what executive action could look like. And so, for example, yesterday there was a article by Elizabeth Warren in BuzzFeed, which talked about exactly what a first 100-day strategy could look like and what's within the scope of executive action. So I think Tom Steyer's right that something like a climate emergency has got to be top of the list, and that the president is going to have to use a lot of executive authority to make progress on the climate crisis.
Well, and just to make sure listeners know, you called the president the climate denier in chief, Leah, but Bill Weld, who we talked to, does have a comprehensive plan for climate change, and he's a Republican. So it isn't all just the Democrats who say they tackle this. So
I hate to say it, but Bill Weld is a really big outlier, and that's wonderful for your state, and I really support that. And I wish I could say that there were people like John McCain still around today or Bob Inglis. These are Republicans who have made climate change a top priority. But we cannot find any Republicans in Congress right now to even co-sponsor a basic carbon pricing policy that doesn't give away massive breaks to the fossil fuel industry. So, and that really gets back to the issue we talked about earlier, which is that the fossil fuel industry has succeeded in capturing the Republican Party. And we need that to change, because we need every voter, we need every politician to get on board with this crucial issue. I really hope that things can start to change, but they need to start at the top. And unfortunately, President Trump has been very active in promoting climate denial.
Did you want to jump in, Annie, on that?
I was just thinking about the banning. I was going to use this as an opportunity to promote my spreadsheets.
Go ahead.
Just as far as banning fossil fuel leasing on and offshore, I mean, Leah's right that that's sort of one of the top line potential executive actions that almost every single candidate who's still in the race touts. Michael Bennett is the exception there, and he does come from an area of the country that benefits economically from that kind of public land leasing, so it makes some sense that he would be leery of that kind of ban. But if people go to our website, nhpr.org, you can find some visual comparisons of all the candidates' plans, and I've also taken the liberty of making you a nice spreadsheet comparing all of the candidates' plans in more detail, including on a lot of the issues we've talked about here. And I mean, it's interesting how detailed you do have to get before you can see some of those differences emerge. I mean, I think we see people on the Democratic side especially sort of broadly accept the terms of climate action, and it's the devil is in the details on this kind of stuff, and the sense of urgency is in the details. And so you can see that when you really get into the nitty-gritty of their plans.
And there is a lot of detail. Yeah. I've gone through some of these plans, and they are many, many, many pages long. Oh, and yeah. I know, Annie, you've had even more patience for that than me.
I even had a campaign staffer say, wow, you read all those plans. Well, you wrote them, so...
Well, and we'll put a link on our website if you want to check that out. It is nhpr.org/exchange. Once again, nhpr.org/exchange. Michael writes in, he objects to your language, Leah, calling all Republicans climate deniers. Michael says, according to many, many recent polls, 2/3 of Republicans think the climate change is caused by humans and that it is real. Differing in our responses, Michael says, is not the same as denying climate change. So you, he says, me, I'm allowing you to label millions of Americans as climate deniers, implying a backwards view of science. So can you just talk about that, Leah, that yes, the president has not taken action on climate change. I haven't followed up on his most recent statements, but the last time I checked, he is not concerned about this at all. Bill Weld, as we said, is concerned. But what about the Republican, you know, regular Republicans living in Concord or Manchester or anywhere, you know, across the country?
Yeah. So, I apologize if Michael felt offended. I was not speaking about Republicans within the public. I think he is 100% correct that there is broad-based belief in climate change amongst Republicans, and that is particularly strong amongst younger Republicans. And I think that's excellent, and I want to see that grow and build. And I don't think that this should be a partisan issue, but it is a partisan issue when it comes to our Republican politicians across this country. And it has been like that for over a decade now. We used to have a few Republican champions in Congress, like I mentioned, John McCain and Bob Inglis. But in the case of Bob Inglis, he was primaried by the fossil fuel industry. They said, no, you're not allowed to believe in climate change and hold this congressional seat. We're going to challenge you and put a lot of money into a race against you. So I'm not blaming everyday Republicans. And I think it's wonderful that more and more Republicans are going to step up and say to their Republican politicians, this is not okay. You cannot continue to promote climate denial. But unfortunately, within our elected politicians, that shift has not really begun to happen yet.
Okay. Well, Michael, we really appreciate you emailing. We take your questions, comments, and criticisms, so we welcome that. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Getting into the politics again, John emails, we know that making a campaign promise and getting a bill approved are two different things. John says, I would like to know from the presidential candidates what my part is individually in order to get some of these measures approved. And Leah, go ahead. You're the political scientist. So thanks, John, for the email.
Well, I think that this speaks back to Michael's point, too, which is that it doesn't matter what your partisanship is. You could be a Republican, an independent, or a Democrat. If you care about climate change, there's lots that you can do, and you are more than welcome to go to candidate forums and talk to people, to write to your representative. I would really encourage Republicans to write to their representatives and say that they, you know, support climate action. Because as I mentioned, this research that I've done shows that fossil fuel companies who have really big access to our politicians are distorting what the public actually wants on climate change. So I think that if people get involved in the political system and they make their views known, that's the most important thing we can do in terms of individual action, because it needs to be clear to politicians of every stripe that we all want a livable planet for our future generations and for our own lives. And that doesn't matter what political stripe we come from. We want to keep a place that is good for all people.
You know, we've talked a lot about energy production. We've talked a lot about politics. We talked a lot about sort of carbon capture and whether that works or not. I'd like to ask both of you in just the couple minutes we have left about transportation. That's another big sector that contributes to carbon. And what general ideas, Annie, are you hearing candidates share on a cleaner transportation system?
Yeah, this is a really big focus of their plans. I mean, we should say, so they basically will sort the energy and emissions transformations into, you know, the energy and electric generation system, heating, the building sector and construction and sort of the heating and cooling of buildings, transportation, and then sort of public lands, agriculture, forestry, that conservation, that kind of thing. So for transportation, they talk a lot about electric vehicles. Many candidates will say they want all new model vehicles for passengers to be electric or zero emissions by after, you know, sometimes 2030, which is a really, you know, it's interesting, I think, how many people have signed on to what on paper sounds pretty like a bit of a radical shift, right? And so you see
2030 is not that far away.
More candidates than just the hardest left progressives endorsing that idea. So that, you know, I think is a priority and something that people feel is doable. I mean, we are seeing the auto industry move in that direction. They also talk a lot about electric vehicle infrastructure and then also public transportation. So introducing more surface level transit in cities and more ability for people to take high-speed rail to work. So especially targeting places that don't have great public transit infrastructure right now, or maybe where driving is their only option.
Like New Hampshire.
Exactly like New Hampshire. And we're seeing great investment in that here. And that's something that the candidates are interested in as well.
Wow, there's so much more we could have talked about. But maybe the candidates will talk more about this tonight at their debate in Los Angeles.
Sure hope so.
I know both of you will be watching that. Leah, thank you for getting up early out there in California and for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on.
That's Leah Stokes, assistant professor of political science at UC Santa Barbara. Leah's forthcoming book is called Short-Circuiting Policy, Interest Groups and the Battle Over Clean Energy and Climate Policy in the American States. And Annie Ropeek, thank you once again very much for helping us out on The Exchange. We always appreciate it.
Thanks for the opportunity.
That's Annie Ropeek, NHPR's energy and environment reporter. And as we said earlier, we will put links to Annie's work on the presidential candidates and their climate positions on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.